This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
You don't come to Britain for Baroque, or do you? The swelling curve, the glinting dome, the cascading steps, the statue that beckons you from terrace to portico. For all that, you go to Venice or Madrid. Britain has been a little more hostile to such things. Baroque style in architecture was an import from Catholic Europe, and however soberly you painted the walls, a suspicious air of extravagance persisted. The showiness, the artifice, the gleeful deviance and self-assertion, it just wasn't British. Far better a good bit of Palladian refinement, advancing on the principle of less is more. Wren had to use a thoroughly Baroque bit of trickery in the construction of St. Paul's Cathedral, hiding his riskily popish dome behind scaffolding until it was too late for his detractors to insist that he take it down. In the early 20th century, when the National Trust started to conserve English buildings, it looked for domestic craftsmanship and authenticity, places that told stories of old England. Swaggering Baroque palaces could look after themselves, or perhaps it might be better if they fell down. We only have to look at British dictionary definitions to catch the tone of disapproval. Chambers says that Baroque arose with the Counter-Reformation and prevailed in Louis XIV's time before degenerating into tasteless extravagance of ornament. And yet, for all this, somehow, British Baroque is still putting on a show. Devotees have spoken up for it so that now we can look round at a startlingly rich inheritance. The gardens at Rest Park in Bedfordshire reopened in 2011 after transformative conservation work. And if you want to feel how Baroque works spatially, go there. Such places really put our modern manners to the test. We're not used to the formality of a great flat lawn, which is really a big green stage, or the wide ornamental canal inspired by Versailles, which aspires to leave its natural rippling wateriness behind and become a perfect mirror. Or the pavilion, which takes tips from Borromini, elliptical spatial folds unpacked in a high-pressure explosion of trompe l'oeil. I sat and watched as people crossed the grass. Either they took up the challenge and put on a performance, or they looked hopefully about for some dip or dell or bank to sit on, found none, and went away to the woodland at the side. We like to loiter in semi-secret spots, but the Baroque keeps moving us on. I spent a hot afternoon at Hampton Court last summer, visiting the Privy Garden with its huge restored parterre. The gravel paths led me round box-edged arabesques, but where could I stop? Not on the path, I'd spoil the design. Not on the flight of wide stone steps, which are there only for making an entrance. On I went until my eyes ached with bright sun on gravel, until entering a closely covered walkway and being plunged into darkness. No, the Baroque just doesn't do dappled shade. Part of the great value of preserving these spaces is that they make us so conscious of our behaviour. I wrote this essay in the Radcliffe Camera in Oxford, designed mostly by James Gibbs, though the most distinctive idea, its circularity, came from Hawksmoor. In characteristically morbid style, Hawksmoor was thinking of the huge drum-like Roman tomb on the Appian Way, a fact better forgotten unless you like the notion of reading in a mausoleum. Sometimes the building does seem to frown at you for being alive. In the domed reading room upstairs, every tiny involuntary sound becomes a public announcement. Few buildings make you feel so banal when you sneeze or drop your biro. And yet, few buildings make the task of writing an essay feel so grand. You are deflated and elevated at once. I often wonder whether it's all right at lunchtime to perch in one of the blind niches round the base of the camera to eat a sandwich. I know I'm lowering the tone, but Baroque is good at power struggles, and if we're going to make it work in our modern lives, we have to assert a little power of our own. There are many stories to be told about the modern recognition and recuperation of Baroque. At the turn of the 20th century, there were signs of a fulsome revival. Designers looked to Christopher Wren as the model of the great public architect. the new Renaissance style, that's Renaissance with a W, was suited to commercial and ceremonial buildings where the prime requirement was grandeur. The Port of Liverpool building, for example, announced all the confidence of 1907, standing like a palace on the Mersey, big enough to greet the docking liners with its fortissimo rustication, four cupola-topped turrets, and a central dome that doesn't quite belong to the rest of the building, but never mind. If in doubt in 1907, best to have a dome. This giant office block wasn't much like anything Vanbrugh would have put his name to. There wasn't the magic, the duplicity, the darkness. Still, there were bursts of energy. From inside, the dome seemed to spin like a colour wheel or a kaleidoscope. And most of all, there was the sheer imposing mass of it. Here was a secular cathedral for Liverpool trade. Edwin Lutyens, chief imperial architect, turned his thoughts to the city's need for an actual cathedral for worshippers. He wanted to build in what he called the grand style, and in Baroque tradition, he wanted to surpass all predecessors. The dome was to have been larger than that of St. Peter's in Rome. Arches were to have soared, wings and transepts mounted on top of each other, all confounding and dazzling the eye. People said it would be one of the wonders of the world. The crypt was built during the 1930s, and everyone who passed the building site must have seen in their mind's eye the walls that would rise. But the walls never did rise. After the war, it was all too expensive, too much out of keeping with austerity and modern lightness of design. Even when Lutyens first proposed it in the 1920s, the time for such heavy magnificence, for such cities in stone, had passed. Baroque sensibility in the 1920s and 30s took a different turn. The emphasis was on imagination rather than construction, seductive sensuality rather than massiveness, eccentricity rather than official power. Top of the reading list was a book called Southern Baroque Art by the young aesthete Sir Cheverel Sitwell. He had taken himself off on a tour of Baroque in Spain and southern Italy and written it all up in a series of narrative essays with a verbal exuberance to match his subject. There was something here that caught a mood and answered to a need. Partly, it was the warmth of the night air in Sitwell's descriptions, and the voices from the street filtering in through shuttered windows. But it was more than that. Sitwell was explicitly celebrating everything that contemporary modernist designers most derided. The new architects of functionalism and transparency advocated whitewashed walls for clarity. No distractions, no cover-ups. This was the age of fitted kitchens and foldaway beds. Sitwell's paean to ornamental facades came out at just the same time as Le Corbusier's manifesto towards a new architecture. Corbusier opened with an invocation to the engineer, guided by the laws of economy, whereas Sitwell opened his book with a description of a fountain in Naples, leaping desperately against the sky as if beating on heavenly cymbals. The contrast between these two books really was extreme. Reading Southern Baroque art in the years that followed became a sign of rebellion from the modernist rules. There was certainly an elite cliqueiness to the new appreciation. Interior decorators rushed to provide their clients with scrolled and gilded chairs for their Mayfair drawing rooms. But the Baroque was attracting young thinkers beyond the Mayfair milieu. Geoffrey Jellicoe, who would become perhaps the most celebrated British garden designer of the 20th century, published in 1924 his book Italian Gardens of the Renaissance, a collaboration with his fellow student, John Shepherd. While Sitwell had been following the plume of fountains and the song of nightingales from Caserta to Madrid, Jellicoe and Shepherd had been visiting every major 17th century garden in Italy, measuring the parterres, sketching the balustrades. Jellicoe was entranced by the movement of curves and dramatic alternations of light and shade. At Villa Govi, near Siena, he entered a fantasy land, leaving the sunlight, as he put it, and passing beyond the world beneath forms entwining and twisting in the gloom. Contrast and contrapposto had him in thrall. Evelyn Waugh remembered his own conversion to the Baroque when he described Charles Ryder falling in love with Brideshead. The great house is half empty and under wraps, but a few shafts of light reveal gilt mirrors and pilasters, and outside on the terrace is a giant stone fountain brought from Italy, carved with tropical animals and an obelisk, anglicised by a few wild ferns growing in the damp stone cracks under a fitful English sun. Here, remembers Charles, here under that high and insolent dome, here as I sat hour by hour before the fountain, rejoicing in its clustered feats of daring and invention, I felt a whole new system of nerves alive within me. This is a novel of overwhelming nostalgia, but also of new beginnings and strange survivals. The dome is insolent in its grandness, and insolent because it refuses to go quietly. The dome at Castle Howard, one of War's models for Brideshead, was destroyed by fire in 1940. But amazingly, George Howard set about rebuilding it. By 1962, the dome was restored to Vanbrugh's design, and Pellegrini's ceiling was recreated inside. Today it is looking imperturbably insolent once again. That's typical Baroque staying power. I wonder if there's something particularly haunting about the Baroque that makes it difficult to let these buildings fade. Perhaps it's because they're so animated, so mobile for all their heaviness, that they seem somehow to live. And they are personal buildings. In a Hawksmoor church, you feel the architect in every cornice, as you feel the director's controlling vision in every scene of an auteur's film. There have been repeated proposals to demolish 17th century city churches, which occupy some of the most pressurised real estate in London. But public opposition has always shouted these proposals down. All Hallows in Lombard Street became structurally dangerous and was dismantled in 1939. But the tower was rebuilt stone by stone in Twickenham. St Augustine Watling Street was ruined in the Blitz. But again, the stones, as if magnetic, could not be thrown away for rubble. The tower was reconstructed, complete with a copy of Hawksmoor's steeple made in fiberglass. Peter Ackroyd's novel Hawksmoor is founded on this insistence of the past. The 18th century plot imposes itself on the 20th century plot. The mad, visionary Baroque church architect and his modern namesake become muddled. For who could say where one had ended and the other had begun? The surprising endurance of Baroque was something that struck the artist John Piper, especially when he visited Vanbrugh's Northumbrian masterpiece, Seton Delaval. The house had been burnt out in the 1820s, but the main walls and the frontage still stood, with all their tough northern rustication, sooty and stained, improved, some said, by the scars. It was still a palace, Piper thought, a drop scene for drama in four dimensions. He painted it spotlit, as if for an opera, brilliantly catching the shifty movement between solidity and facade. Knowing that Baroque loves the night for its performances, he sank the rear of the building deep in shadow, beneath a black sky, with a spectral, smoky shaft of white light from some unseen moon. Seton Delaval was bought by the National Trust with help from 30,000 supporters. It opened to the public this weekend. And so it survives to meet whatever the 21st century asks of it. And if you thought the Baroque never flourished in Britain, just look at it now.